Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, are people laughing too much at the theaters? Not at the comedies, mind you. Those basically don't exist anymore, much to the chagrin of studio execs who could use the occasional $10 million budgeted movie blowing up for $100 million from teenagers who need something to laugh at. But I'm talking about movies where you're not supposed to be laughing. Movies being laughed at inappropriate times. Writing in the New York Times, Marie Solis highlights the scourge of I like to think of this almost as a Jerry Seinfeld bit, a Seinfeld episode, right? Like, he might call it the inappropriate laugher. Like, she laughed during the crying game. She laughed during the crying game, Jerry. That's an inappropriate laugher right there. You're dating an inappropriate laugher. In the opening paragraphs of this piece, Solis highlights one guy who, like, cracked up during Queer and Nosferatu at inappropriate times. Now, I haven't seen Queer. I can't say whether or not it's funny and should be laughed at while Daniel Craig is doing heroin on the streets of Cuba or whatever. But the Nosferatu I have seen, and I enjoyed it, and the moment of laughter highlighted here, which involved Lily Rose Depp's character having a breakdown because she's in the throes of vampiric possession, would in fact be a terrible time to uproariously laugh. That would be an inappropriate laugher situation. But the next piece, the next example in the piece highlights something a little more complicated. I'm just going to read the paragraph from the New York Times story in whole. Quote, in an essay for Angel Food magazine, Marla Cruz, a writer in Los Angeles, described her disgusted reaction to the audience's behavior during the scene in Anora when a henchman discovers the female protagonist bound and bent over. I cried quietly in the back row of the theater, nauseated by the audience's laughter, she wrote. End quote. And now, if this is the sequence I'm thinking of, and it's one in which Anora is trying to escape from the Armenians who have been sent to collect her, during which she, like, breaks one of their noses and also screams rape while crucially not being raped, it should be pointed out, only to wind up being restrained and gagged, it's one that's played for comic effect in the movie, right? We smash cut to her staring kind of staring daggers at the camera after a very intentionally slapstick sequence that calls to mind something like a slightly more realistic Coen Brothers movie. The whole sequence is very intentionally funny, maybe darkly comic, we could say, but it's very intentionally funny. And any distress at hearing laughter here likely has more to do with some other unresolved trauma that the author may have suffered. What the phenomenon of the inappropriate laugher is absolutely getting at and is absolutely a thing that has been kind of swirling around the conversation as, you know, particularly as Rep House audiences have returned and a younger generation is checking out some earlier stuff by David Lynch, like Blue Velvet or the Douglas Sirk melodramas. Lots of sniggering laughter of the sort that could be thought of as dismissive, perhaps even like weirdly superior, as if modern audiences think they're a little bit better than the people they're seeing on screen. I remember hearing a story about somebody cracking up during a sincere moment in, I think it was Singing in the Rain, and the guy who was watching it just wanted to like start screaming at all of them. You know, what's the matter with you? Get out of here if you can't handle, you know, adult emotions, etc. Now, part of the issue, as always, is that hell is other people. Right? That includes people in movie theaters, audience members who prop their feet up on chairs in front of them while kicking their shoes off, phone users, inappropriate laughers. These are all subspecies of the same basic variety of annoying person, that guy who has no idea how to behave in public. But I do think that there's something to the idea of genre collapse contributing to all of this, right? We live in an age where comedy is a key part of almost every genre, from cheap horror to big budget franchise fare. Comedy has been rolled into nearly everything we watch. And as a result, some audiences, particularly some younger audiences, may be primed for laughter, even when no laughter is, strictly speaking, appropriate. Alyssa, what's the matter with audiences?
I mean, I feel like one aspect of this that we're not talking about is that laughter is a physical response as well as a social one, and people laugh for reasons other than that they think something is purely funny or a joke, right? I mean, a lot of these scenes where people are laughing are, you know, are genuinely disconcerting, right? And laughter is a way of putting distance between yourself and something that you find upsetting or uncomfortable, or that you, you know, sort of want to socially distance yourself from. And it's also not something that people entirely can control. It's also contagious. So if one person laughs, other people often will as well. But laughter can also be a way of, you know, sort of an expression of sort of critical judgment, right? I mean, if you find the way Lily Rose Depp's contortions in Nosferatu to not actually sort of transport you to an environment in which evil is real and operative in the world, like, laughter could be a way of expressing that you don't think that acting is well done or that the staging works. And so I found this to be just a weirdly, I don't know, sort of judgy, but also just kind of inhuman response to something that people can't always entirely control, but that could have multiple interpretations. I just found it very odd.
Yeah, the place I see this come up most often in my circles, my film Twitter circles, is people getting annoyed at rep house screenings where, usually it's an older movie. Usually it's something a little bit more melodramatic. You know, it is not in the, it is something that is not really shot in the filmed or presented in the mode that we think of when we think of movies today, which is fairly realism based. Like, I feel like we've had a real move toward realism and not really lingering on the melodramatic, which again, I do think it can be frustrating for people in the other people in the audience, right? Peter, like, if you are going to, a rep house in New York City and you're sitting down to watch, I don't know, something you regard to be as very personal and important and a classic to you, and some joker two rows over starts cracking up every time, a character is on the screen acting in an overtly different sort of way, it's very frustrating.
Look, there's obviously a line that is hard to define precisely, but if you are laughing obnoxiously and perhaps even murderously, like Robert De Niro's character in Cape Fear at the movie theater, we've all seen that movie, right? The Scorsese remake of Cape Fear. There's a fantastic scene in which Robert De Niro's character, who turns out to be like a totally murderous psycho, but the movie is about the line of like, how far can you kind of push like social unacceptability, right? Like, and so much of the film is just sort of like, well, he's doing stuff that's weird and off-putting and maybe even like quite creepy, but it's not illegal. It's not right. Like, but like eventually he's a killer, right? Like, he's just a crazy freaking killer. And the whole movie's about that. So there's a way in which someone can go overboard for sure. And I don't want to say that there's no way that anybody can ever be can ever laugh in a way that's inappropriate or rude at a movie theater. At the same time, I'm struggling to think of a moment in which I have heard laughter in a movie theater that is directed at the events on the screen and been annoyed by it. Yes, I've heard laughter from a bunch of like teenagers who are not actually watching the movie. They're just talking to themselves. And that's annoying. But if you are engaging with the movie directly on its own terms in a movie theater, and you're doing so in a way that is somewhere short of Robert De Niro's murderous cackles in Cape Fear, I have a hard time faulting you, because the point of going to the movie theater is to be around other people and to experience their reactions to it. And sometimes somebody else, I have laughed at moments when I have been, I wouldn't say this is super common, but I've certainly been the lone laugher in a movie theater. And when I think that no one else in the theater gets how like kind of minutely and acutely funny something is going on, I'm struggling to think of an example, but I know it's happened. Not a lot, but it has. And I've also been in theaters where somebody else just thinks this is a hoot, and I don't know what the hell they're thinking, like what they're reacting to. I think several of us have talked about seeing Conclave and hearing physical kind of loud outbursts at the end of the movie, which is very much not intended to be a joke, but it is. It's an expression
of critical judgment, right?
Yes. It's also, it's so out of, if you are not really paying finally like close attention to the text of that film. I do think like the end makes sense. Like it is set up. It's clear. Like it's like you see like a through line. But at the same time, I think for a lot of people, the ending to that movie feels so out of left field that the only possible response is to cackle, is to say, what the hell? And that's not crazy. I didn't. But like I can imagine that response. And I think that if people are engaging in something like good faith and social reasonability with a movie, then it's OK to laugh. It's not OK to laugh if you are telling a joke to your friends who are and it's not about the movie. It's not OK to just sort of sit there and be loud and like distract from the film. But there is a kind of, and again, it's hard to sort of like settle on what firmly describe the line, because there are people who are like, what I want is to engage with the movie by yelling at the screen constantly. Also not okay. But I want to see a movie with people who are actually engaged with it and involved with it. And frankly, there's too little of that happening in movie theaters. Too many people who are like, watching. I've now seen on at least three occasions in the past year, people spend the entire movie not just on their phone texting, but watching TikTok. You're in a movie theater and you're watching the little screen. You're watching movies on the little screen, and it just drives me crazy. And I want to anyway, like it's I don't know. And I also, we all have different ideas about what's funny.
Yeah. But also, Peter, I mean, you know, you sort of said a couple of times that the point of movies is to go be around other people and their reactions. And I think, you know, an aspect of the sort of move to living much of our lives online is that a lot of people are just very accustomed to living within their own emotional weather systems and don't have a lot of other contact with people who kind of disagree with each other, with them, are going to have different reactions to things than them, have different sort of worldviews or ways of moving through the world. And look, I mean, I think there are certainly situations where, you know, it may be very jarring to encounter those reactions. You know, I mean, if you're in a movie theater and you're suddenly sort of ambushed by something that, you know, correlates very closely to a personal trauma that you had, but it's shot in a way that people could have varied reactions to it. Again, I understand having a strong sort of reaction to that, but I have a much harder time with the idea that you should then declare everyone else's reaction sort of socially inappropriate or morally inappropriate. And, you know, I think people need... The movie theater is an illustration of the fact that a lot of us have ended up living in very narrow boxes over the last 5 years. And maybe it's a good place to start getting outside of those boxes again and being exposed to other people's reactions in a sort of low stakes, non-confrontational way. But clearly, like, I think people are just socially out of practice. And I had a very hard time relating to this article, in part because it seemed to me to be a product of, you know, just that kind of isolation in a way that I have trouble sympathizing with.
I do specifically remember one instance in which I cackled in a movie theater at a point when I was the only person who did so. And that was actually seeing the movie Ratatouille when I was, I don't know, in my early 20s or something like that. And the moment at which the critic has the Ratatouille and like is reduced to his childhood self and like suddenly all right. It's just like it's such a perfect deconstruction of what critics do. Of like how to like get to the heart of a mean-spirited critic who thinks that he's like above everything and has seen it all. It's like, no, it's like you just tapped into like the thing that he was missing from his childhood. And as somebody who was like just starting out writing about movies and was like thinking an awful lot about movie criticism, it was so perfect and so surprising to me that they had that, like, in fact, it tapped into the thing that I was feeling as a critic at the time. And I cackled, and my mom, I saw this movie with my family because it's like I've got much younger siblings and I was at home at the time. And my mom actually like elbowed me because I was the only person the person in the theater who went like, aha! because it's a great moment. But here's the other thing that I think that this piece misses, and that I just want to add in real quickly. What is the genre that has in many ways taken the place of comedy over the past 15 years as comedies have moved out, studios have stopped producing them, and theaters people stopped going to see movies at theaters? Horror. And one of the things about modern horror, Sonny's talked about the sort of blurry lines of comedy, the way it seeped into other movies. But one of the things about modern horror is that a lot of successful modern horror films toy with the idea of comedy and are sort of moving back and forth between zones of like deep physical uncomfortableness and frankly, like hyper-violence and comedy. And they are showing you ways in which things can be both disgusting and awful and and dramatic and unpleasant and not in any way funny. And then in the next moment, the killer will do something that's sort of so grandiosely gory and ridiculous that you kind of have to laugh. And even something absurdly gross out like the Terrifier films is absolutely playing with notions of visceral disgust and horror, but also with kind of comic timing. And you see this all throughout modern horror and the kind of Blumhouse school of things. There is this weird sense of off-kilter, off-balance comedy that goes along with moments that should not be funny, but they are. And they are often intended as such, and that is trained viewers to find comedy in those awkward moments.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly saw that in something like the Super Bowl ad for Megan 2 last night, which is set to, you know, Chapel Roan's Feminine Phenomenon. It's like that, you know, I don't like horror, but the introduction in general, like speaking broadly, but the introduction of humor into a lot of this has made it much more palatable for me to watch.
Yeah. It's interesting. I went back and tried to find the thing that I was thinking about, and it was at the Music Box Theater, which was back in 2024. There was a showing of Blue Velvet that was a rated Q screening, which is their LGBT program. The theater actually put out a statement that said in part, loudly mocking abuse on the screen and making dedicated patrons feel uncomfortable is disgusting, shameful behavior, and not what Rated Q or the Music Box stands for. Which is interesting because it implies a sense of ownership an idea that if you are going to a specific series or a specific theater, that you should be expected to react a certain way to the things that you are seeing on the screen. Now, Peter, I think you guys have seen Blue Velvet, right?
Yep.
Never in a movie theater, but yeah.
The sequence in particular that caused the reaction was the shots of Isabella Rossellini being abused by Dennis Hopper, which I think there was some cackling, some hooting and hollering, which of course, again, led to this reaction from the longtime patrons, the anger there. And I you know, again, it's one of the, I'm pretty sympathetic to this idea that if you put together a screening series, if you are engaged in that sort of thing, if you have a regular audience, that it is inappropriate to have a reaction like that to the film. I don't know what the proper response is here. Was Music Box supposed to like throw on the lights and kick all these guys out? Like, I don't know what you want from folks, but I do think that it is I'm not saying people should sit in silence and watch everything, you know, quietly taking notes the whole time, like, some of us do, but it, you know, just be decent.
Yeah.
That can be a little bit tricky sometimes. I think sometimes it's not tricky and people are just obviously not being decent. But one thing that can be done, it doesn't solve all of your problems, but it goes at least a little way, is to just set clear expectations. And one thing I love about the Alamo is the absolute aggressiveness, almost obnoxiousness of their, if you're too loud and you're talking, we'll kick you out of the theater and we allow people to report you. Now, I've never seen it actually done in an Alamo. It's never happened where I've seen somebody get kicked out or I've seen somebody else get reported, and I've every now and then, you know, been in a screening with a loud talker. But for the most part, the audiences there are just much better behaved. And I think that is at least in part because they go way out of their way, first with a nice and funny version of the don't talk and don't text reminder, and then with a secondary follow up, like, no, we're really serious, we will throw you out ad, that they don't then actually have to do much to enforce because they have set clear rules of the road. And having that at different types of screening, the rules might be different in some places. And in fact, Alamo has different rules. They have kid friendly screenings, but also like movie parties where they encourage people to be loud and throw stuff and have fun. And more explicit setting of expectations is going to get people more of what they want, especially if you have, say, a repertoire theater that has a bunch of regulars and like they have expectations about what things are going to be like.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that the inappropriate laugher is a thing? I don't know. Peter.
Tricky, actually. I think that most inappropriate laughers are non-troversies, but Robert De Niro in Cape Fear, kind of controversial.
Alyssa.
I think the fact that we're not accustomed to being around other people and their mental weather is a controversy. We should all work on that.
I think it's a controversy. People are jerks. Go home, jerks. Stay away from decent people. I hate you.
Go see movies at the theater unless you're a jerk.
Only non-jerks in theaters, please. That would be great. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus. On Friday, we're going to be talking about the next generation of stars and why they feel, I don't know, kind of fresh and exciting. And now on to the main event. I'm Still Here. It's the other foreign film nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars this year. It's not Emilia Perez, the narco-trafficking trans musical opera that has been dragged through the mud in recent. It's the other foreign film nominated for Best Picture. It's about one family's life under Brazil's military dictatorship in the 1970s. Brazilian Congressman Rubens Paiva, who's played by Selton Mello, returns to the nation after a half decade in exile following the ascendancy of a military dictatorship. He had been kicked, essentially, you know, he fled for his own safety. He came back to live with his wife, Eunice, who's played by Fernando Torres, and their five children near the beach, all while planning to build another house outside of Rio in the jungle. For the first 30 minutes or so, we see their life as they lived it. Trips to the beach, dinner parties with friends, the occasional envelope slipped under doors, the occasional search by the military forces and stopped cars after, say, left-wing insurgents kidnap a foreign ambassador and demand the release of 70 prisoners. There is a hovering dread over the city and the family, even amongst their joyous return to Brazil and the friendliness of the father to his children and adult friends alike. It's a dread that is realized when there's an unexpected knock at the door and a team of military police take Rubens first and then Eunice and one of their daughters off to jail for questioning. What follows is an exercise in uncertainty and unknowing. We see all of this from Eunice's POV, and it is in that limited POV that we discover the true terror of authoritarianism, of this sort of fascist government. She does not know how long she is kept in the military barracks, where she has found herself answering questions. She's being asked over and over again to identify faces in mugshot books, and she becomes more and more aghast as she sees the face of her husband and then herself and then her daughter has been added to the pages. She does not know if her husband is still there. She does not know if her daughter is being tortured, at least until a sympathetic guard tells her that the girl has been let go. And after Eunice is released, the uncertainty continues. No one really knows where her husband is or if he's alive. This existential uncertainty leads to a variety of personal indignities. Among them, she cannot withdraw funds from their bank account. They're all in the husband's name. All the while, she knows she cannot push too hard or too fast or make too great waves, since the military dictatorship could take reprisals against her or her family or their friends. One of the lessons of the film, and this is stated explicitly by Eunice in the film, is that the greatest crime of such dictatorships is simply withholding information from victims. If you cannot move on, if there's no body to bury, if there's no way to say goodbye, whole families are kept in a state of suspended animation, which, you know, makes it impossible to move forward and recover what sense of normalcy you're able to. I'm Still Here is anchored by Torres's performance. She was nominated for an Oscar for good reason. But everyone in the movie does a really pretty incredible work. It's a real actor showcase. Mello, his work is Rubens, in which you see him both as a loving father and committed activist, is really very moving, frankly. The shots at the end of the film where we see him in photos with the with younger versions of his now adult children are very moving and touching. I didn't get their names, so I can't tell you the actors' names here, but the dead-eyed performances by the thugs who show up to the house to take the family away are equally impressive, just kind of in the opposite direction, just chilling. It's a really remarkable portrait of the banality of evil. Peter, what did you make of I'm Still Here?
I really like this movie, and if I had seen it before making my top 10 list, it almost certainly would have, definitely would have made the list. This was a particularly powerful or, I don't know, it hit at the right moment for me for a couple of reasons. And one is that I saw this movie over the weekend on the same day that I appeared on a couple of panels at LibertyCon here in Washington, D.C. Since I'm the token libertarian, I'll explain what that is. This is the annual conference put on by a group called Students for Liberty, which has a lot of not only domestic chapters, but also a bunch of international chapters. And it's always pretty amazing because you go to this conference. I go not every year, but I go and I sometimes present. I've been going for a while. And what you see is, you know, there are all of these American like college students who are interested in kind of libertarian-ish sort of ideas of freedom. They are doing what they can, and they're doing great work, truly incredible work, many of them. But then there are all of these chapters that come in from overseas, in particular from Latin America, but also just all over the world. And it's like here in America, the student libertarians are like, we started a chapter and we have a book club and we've done, and this is great stuff. And then overseas, it's like, yeah, we got our friends out of prison after they'd been disappeared for 15 days, and we simply couldn't find which facility they were being held in. Stories that have a lot of resonance with this movie. And it's just, they're living under conditions at times that are just incredible to think about, and the fact that they're then able to sort of to band together and to find some way to sort of push back against some of these governments. It always kind of hits me harder than I think when I go to that conference, and then to see this movie on the same day was something. And then, you know, I know this is the movies podcast and not the political podcast, but I have been thinking a lot about rules and norms and how they're important in government. I live here in Washington, and a lot of my job is actually to follow, you know, big federal politics news. And what is the drama in this movie? Yes, it's about, you know, an authoritarian government who takes somebody and tortures them and eventually kills them, and then the fallout from the family. It's horrific. But so much of the actual minute-to-minute drama is not about the death. By the time we get about halfway through this movie, it's pretty clear that Rubens is dead, that he's not coming back, that whatever happened to him, it was horrible and his life is over. And so it is the quest instead simply for paperwork and to get the government to, it's not just to give them information, but to acknowledge formally that first that he had been arrested. I mean, there's a whole bit in the middle of the movie in which the wife and the lawyer are just like, what we need is any piece of paper that is official that says he was arrested at all. And the way that the government, that the military dictatorship there had asserted its power was simply not to avoid the paperwork and to not follow the procedures. And the culmination of all of this, it isn't the moment when the dictatorship falls, which it did, right? And so by the 1980s, the dictators, there was a new constitution and there was a new government in Brazil. But that's not the victory here. We don't get the celebration when the dictators go away. That's not what this movie is about. The climax of this film is just when the wife gets a death certificate. It's just a piece of paper in a government office that acknowledges this happened. And we are going to officially have a record that this happened. And that is an undermade point in politics, I think, and in movies about politics and stories about politics, is that those little procedural details in which you just have the pieces of paper and everybody has to comply and you just have to do the thing the way that it says in the books, that's what keeps the dictators at bay. And when the politicians aren't following the rules like that, that's when you start to have problems.
Yeah, I do think I love that this movie, I'm Still Here, is so narrowly focused. It is not on the grand ideological struggle between left and right in Brazil. It only barely
acknowledges that Rubens was a leftist, almost certainly had some sort of straightforwardly communist sympathies.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that I think it is a great strength of this film that it is not involved in the nitty-gritty of that conflict and that battle, just because it, by keeping it tightly focused on the family and on Eunice's awful predicament, it personalizes it in a way that would otherwise be difficult. Though, Alyssa, as Peter suggests, it's almost unfathomable to an American to think about how this sort of general day-to-day skullduggery and thuggery on a governmental level.
I mean, I'd push back against that a little bit, right? I mean, not that I think, I mean, America has not been a military dictatorship in the way that, that Brazil or, Argentina or Chile were military dictatorships. But, you have had sort of rogue programs like COINTELPRO. I mean, you've had, cities where you've got the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia. But those have very much been sort of the exceptions to the rule. I think it's much harder for folks to imagine sort of a scenario where everyone is vulnerable to this kind of sort of government terrorism. I think that's true.
Yeah. Alyssa, what did you make of the movie?
I like this a lot for all of the reasons that Peter has mentioned. But there was an additional aspect of it that I found really sort of unexpectedly wrenching. And that was the fact that sort of threaded throughout this is these snippets of sort of home movies, right? That especially the oldest daughter, Veroca, is making both in Brazil and then when she moves to London. And there's this moment towards the end of the movie where Eunice, sort of kind of sees her husband come alive again, right? I mean, she gets to see him, at the beach with his kids, dancing with her, sort of just, she literally gets to see him move. And I don't think she necessarily hears his voice. I'm not sure there's sound with these movies. But there is this sense of, by documenting someone, you keep their memory alive, not just in the sort of legalistic sense, but you can kind of bring them back to life. And I mean, I found that very affecting. I think I've talked about this on the podcast, but in the summer of 2020, my uncle and my grandmother died within a couple of days of each other. And we couldn't be together for memorial services. But one thing that brought me a lot of unexpected comfort is that in the couple of years previous, Apple had introduced sort of live photos in iPhone where, when you took a picture, you essentially got a tiny snippet of video with a bunch of different frames. And all of a sudden, there were these relatives where I'd never consciously taken sort of home movies of them, but I could get a snippet of my uncle's voice, talking to my daughter or my grandmother saying something. And this movie captures that kind of sort of that ability to sort of, wake the dead at a moment when it was really sort of in its infancy, when it was not something that was available to everyone. And, it underscores the fact that Eunice and her family were exceptional in a lot of ways, right? I mean, they were exceptional in that they were singled out by the government, but they also had the sort of resources and network to pursue Rubin's case and to be persistent. Eunice had the sort of personal fortitude to not just kind of survive this tragedy, but to make a life, a big life for herself, for her kids. And, you know, the idea, there's this idea in the movie that the ability to document things, to sort of persistently document them, is a really profound privilege. And I think it, you know, you can watch it and find resonance for a lot of reasons, whether you're thinking about sort of, wait, how do we resist dictatorship? You know, what's the importance of the rule of law? But also just the sort of the privilege that we all have to document so much of our lives that can become incredibly clear and precious when you least expect it.
There's a kind of running theme through the film where the mother is trying to get her photographs in order. She's like, if I don't do it, I won't be able to keep track of it all. And there's a question about, they come across a photo. They're like, when was this? Whose birthday was this? And I think it is the last image of their father, which nobody really realizes until the mother does.
It's the moment before the roof falls in.
Yeah, which is again, it's like I found the movie to be profoundly moving from a parental, you know, just kids and parents and fathers and daughters and sons and that sort of thing. But that's because I am a sucker for that sort of stuff now after having kids myself. I'm weak.
It also looks great. It's just gorgeous film, like understatedly so.
Yeah, that's the other thing is that it looks great without being flashy. This is not a movie that screams like, hey, look at our cinematography. It just exists and looks good and nice and is kind of expertly understated, which is always a treat. I don't know. I hope folks check it out. This is, you know, one reason why we have the Oscars is to highlight things that otherwise might get lost in the shuffle. If you're going to watch one foreign movie nominated for Best Picture this year, I would make it this one. If you got to make a choice. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on I'm Still Here? Peter.
Thumbs up. I don't think it's playing in very many theaters, but if you can find a screening, it's worth going. And I believe it will be out on streaming in April or May.
Alyssa.
Thumbs up. It's really terrific.
Yeah, thumbs up. And as Peter said, I don't know how many places it's playing. I assume it'll be coming to video on demand here shortly to take advantage of the Oscar time frame. But I am rarely frustrated by not being able to get to see foreign films in theaters. I'm not a foreign film guy. That's not my bailiwick. But the difficulty of seeing this in theaters and also Seed of a Sacred Fig, which is another Oscar-nominated movie that's getting a lot of buzz and I would really like to see in theaters, but it can't, just not playing anywhere and isn't online yet. So I don't know. It would be nice to be able to see more of these things. But then I'd go and some jerk would be laughing in the theater.
Yeah, well, it's always other people, always the problem. Can't live with them. I guess you just can't. You must got to do a podcast with them. It looks like it's playing in about 95 theaters across the United States, maybe a little less than that.
Yeah. This may be one that you listen to this and you put it, just file it away because it should be hitting VOD here. Not too great a period of time. Don't forget it. All right. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If no grow, will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.